Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Good evening, this is Dick Staub at a special edition of the Kindling's Muse at Taproot Theater in Seattle. And we have just watched a performance of The Great Divorce, a work of fantasy of C.S. Lewis, that portrays Christian perceptions of the life after death allegorically. It follows one individual's journey from hell or purgatory, the gray town, to heaven and salvation. And we've just witnessed a wonderful performance of that from Taproot Theater. Can we have a big round of applause for Taproot and their performance? And for those of you listening by podcast who have never visited Taproot, we've invited people to come, and people have actually come from around the country to Taproot as a result of those invitations. We have with us Scott Nolte, who directed this. Good evening, Scott. How are you?
Very fine, thank you.
How did you choose this play?
You know, I was in New York 3 years ago, and I got to have a chance to see this off-Broadway and talk to the director, members of the cast, and I was fascinated. And this story was of interest to me clear back to college. And in working on the play, my wife found our copy of The Great Divorce, and with things highlighted, notes made, because clear back then I saw it as, wouldn't it be interesting if this was a play?
Yeah.
Don't know how, but wouldn't that be interesting?
One of the toughest pieces in this play to do as a play is when the what appears to be the lizard is transformed into the horse.
Yeah.
How did you figure out how you were going to do that? How did they do it on Broadway, first of all?
The off-Broadway production had a lizard that was probably a foot and a half long, and it was really a pretty good-looking, almost jewel-tone lizard. It was very small, and it worked its way across the man's shoulder, and then it was killed by the fire angel, and things somehow morphed away. And then upstage of them, they were like... It was like a Cambodian shadow puppet technique that you could see the transformation, and then you could see them gallop off. And in a thrust configuration like this, we can't use a screen very effectively. So it was like, well, how can we put it on stage? In this case, then the lizard was no longer a foot and a half long. It did have to be larger, but then it was how could we see it go down and then reverse, basically turn inside out and then become the horse.
Yeah. It was very well done. The costume designer is here tonight, and one of the best aspects of this particular production is the use of all the color, and which gave a sense of substance to the characters in heaven, and the grayness and darkness of the creatures that were coming now ghost-like. And that just was vivid. I mean, it just helped establish the themes of the play. We're going to introduce two other guests now, but before we do, George MacDonald appears in this play, and George MacDonald wrote a book called Fantasties, which C.S. Lewis read and really attributed to the reading of that book the awakening of his imagination. He said before he read George MacDonald, he believed that everything that was good and real was imagination, and everything that was boring was strictly logic and reason, and he would not give up imagination if that's what it meant to become part of the faith journey. And in Fantasties, George MacDonald really revealed to Lewis that you could do spiritual exploration in very imaginative ways. And so George MacDonald was a real person. He was a Scottish clergyman. Many of you have read, he wrote a book that's really famous called Diary of an Old Soul. And it's daily readings of George MacDonald. And so the George MacDonald that appears in this play is actually had a huge influence on C.S. Lewis, who then went on to write this play. And George MacDonald, who played George MacDonald? Brilliantly done. And nice job over here as well. These guys were just fab. Everybody here, the whole cast. Well, Scott had what I thought was a really good idea, and that was to invite people from faith traditions to share a little bit about their reaction to the play. Not that they're C.S. Lewis experts, not that they have spent years studying The Great Divorce, but that they're mere mortals who happen to have spent a life thinking about issues like heaven and hell and destiny and choice. And so we're pleased to have with us Rabbi Mark Glickman and Reverend Patricia Hunter, who both write columns for the Seattle Times. And we had invited another friend.
He could be coming.
Who may still be coming. Yeah. He actually appeared on a show with Rabbi Glickman and I on the five-year anniversary of 9/11, which was titled Where Was God on 9/11? So we've had some interesting discussions before. But obviously, contemporary traditions and views of heaven and hell differ within religious traditions. In other words, not everyone in Judaism believes the same thing about heaven and hell, and the same thing in Christianity. So just could you give us a thumbnail sketch of kind of the view that your tradition, as you practice it, brought into a play like this about heaven and hell, and how that was kind of the context for you to receive this work? Let's start with the rabbi.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you ask most Jews if there is such a thing as heaven and hell in Judaism, they will say no, that that's not part of the Jewish religious tradition. And they would say that would be incorrect. We have had notions of the afterlife in Judaism for a long time. In fact, with all due respect, we had it first.
All right.
Well, he got Woody Allen, too, and he knows a lot about heaven and hell.
The thing is that we don't talk about it as much. Judaism has long been much more focused on this world, and it is... I could go on a great length about the images that our tradition draws of heaven and hell. But one important thing to note is that salvation in Judaism is by necessity collective. One of the big choices that we saw in this play was each individual deciding where they were going to go. And in Judaism, I am not saved until we are saved. The we is a very broad we in most conceptions of it, but that in some sense it's not something that I can achieve individually, but it's something that I have to achieve through my interactions by virtue of what happens in the world of which I am a part. The other thing is that in Judaism, salvation, heaven, ultimately is here. It's here in Seattle, and it's in Detroit, and it's in Paris, and it's on Earth. It is the redemption of this world in which we are, rather than something transcendent.
So within the Jewish tradition, when you talk about community, which is absolutely true of your faith as I understand it, but still individuals play a key role, like the characters Abraham.
Oh, of course.
And, you know, they made individual decisions that were worked out in community.
Of course. You know, the great job, and this was, there were some parallels in the play when the George MacDonald character said that there's only one thing to do on earth, and that is to love God. The thing is that in Judaism, that is very specifically defined by actions, not by a feeling, not by a belief, but by doing things that God would want us to do. There are 613 commandments in Jewish scripture, and we are seen as having fulfilled our role as human beings by the extent to which we fulfill those commandments. So the great heroes are the people who play their own role as fully as possible in doing that.
How did you react then to the character who didn't want to go deeper because he was a decent man and he was here to establish his rights? In other words, there was a character in Lewis's story that believed that he had lived a good and decent life and he wasn't going to have any part of heaven that didn't take that into consideration.
Right. And I guess I didn't connect with that only because the real question there was a reflection of, you know, am I going to achieve a salvation or am I not? And that's not the question. The question is, you know, is the world saved yet? And I just add one quick thing because I know we want to get to Dr. Hunter as well. One thing about the image of hell, there is a very distinct image that's painted of hell. It's Chuck E. Cheese at Vacation Time. is very clearly paints that picture.
So long as there's Chuck E. Cheese in Detroit, heaven has not arrived. Or anywhere else for that matter.
The real question in Judaism is, do you merit your place in the world to come or don't you? And you do that through your actions. And ultimately, it's the question of what's happening with the world around us. We have to participate in what's called in Hebrew tikkun olam, repairing the world around us. And salvation isn't done until we're done with that.
Right. Interesting. Dr. Hunter, when you reflect on the Christian tradition that you represent here tonight, first of all, you're involved in a church here in Seattle.
I am.
And what is that church, and how would you describe your perception of heaven and hell?
Well, I am one of the associate ministers of the Mount Zion Baptist Church in Seattle. It's a traditional African-American church. And I think my perspective of what heaven for many Christians actually is a place where people look forward to going to this physical space. It's a space where God is present, and coming from an African-American tradition, that place in heaven is a place where there's no more weeping, no more pain, a place of justice, a place of light and love. And for my foreparents, it would be a place where everybody had shoes, everybody had enough to eat, everybody had clothes to wear, because those things were lacking in many Black church traditions, or with folks who had less than what they actually needed. And so heaven was this place where you had everything you needed. It was also a place where you truly could recognize those who had gone before you, and a place where you would be reunited with those who were already dead.
So what's hell then?
Hell for many people also is a literal place where God is not present, where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth and torment.
Yeah, you had in the story of the gray town in Lewis, you have this people can think a home, and they think homes farther and farther from other people. And there's a sense of separation that Lewis was getting at there. So now when you think about this play, just as a person who came to a play, and it's about heaven and hell, you've already touched, Rabbi, on some of the issues, because in the Christian tradition, while a case can be made that there was actually, in Jesus' perception, a greater continuity between the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition as it relates to community. In other words, he had 12 disciples, he was traveling in community, he believed that the church was community and so forth, something which many people that attend church today can't relate to, but because they don't feel like it's community anymore. So it is very individualistic as its position in our culture. So you reacted from that standpoint, that this is a play about individuals making decisions which is not kind of representative of your tradition. What other things did you find resonating with you and really interesting in this as a treatment of exploring hell, heaven, choices? What were some points of resonance and some points of dissonance for you as you kind of watched this play tonight?
Well, a few things. First, again, I comment on that George MacDonald line. There, the Jewish scripture says you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. And in Judaism, therefore, if you use all your heart and all your soul and all your might for that, then you don't have any heart, soul, or might left over for anything else. And yet, we understand that as in the ways that they're translated into action. You mentioned earlier the costumes, that the costumes of the people who lived in heaven were much more vivid and bright. And yet, remember what I said earlier, that salvation in Judaism is something that happens here. We don't really know what happens there. And so I think if C.S. Lewis were to have been Jewish, the vivid costumes would have been on the other characters, perhaps. And I have to admit, my head is still swimming because every line in the play was just so thought-provoking. So yeah. I'm still processing a lot of it as well.
How about you?
Well, I think one of the lines that resonated with me was that religion can't save you, and that the institution and the religiosity of it all is not salvation.
Yeah, and the people hated religion.
Right, but it was more about knowing who God is. That love, that light, is where one finds.
So excuse me, but I understand that as religion, though. I mean, a religious person is somebody who really lives out the sanctity to which we're called. So that's why I didn't quite connect with that.
Okay, because from Lewis' perspective, religion can be a rote thing. This was written right after World War II. It was written in Britain, Anglican tradition. And in his view, many of the people were culturally Christian, but not really Christian. So he always drew a distinction between religiosity and true faith. And that's interesting because I would imagine most people from a Christian tradition would have connected to that positively, whereas for you, it's like, why is he trashing religion? Well, then you must have really liked the the doubting clergyman who was just the both of you as clerics. I mean, here's the guy that represents the, you know, the man upstairs, and he's this theoretical, conceptual, you know, doubter and skeptic about the whole thing. How did you guys connect to him?
I thought there was a lot of truth in it, though, because I think many clergy believe their own press, and they ought not to do that. And there's so much about the faith and about love that gets lost in, the showmanship of it all.
Yeah.
And about who can get on television and where are the cameras.
Yeah.
When there are actual people that need a place to live, they need love, they need food, they need hope.
Yeah.
And that's not about having a TV camera on in front of somebody in order to get press time.
Yeah.
So I really resonated with that character, maybe in a negative way, but that kind of character is all around us in churches today, which I think is kind of sad.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's really useful in understanding this play is that C.S. Lewis was very influenced by Plato. And so Plato's concept that there are kind of forms here that are the shadow of the real form is how he would explain the real form is the colorful one. It's what we're aspiring to. And what's here is actually not the real. The real is actually there, and that's a Platonic idea. And you see that a lot in this work. Is that, for instance, one of the interesting things to me is that the way Lewis wrestles with whether lust or a love of art, how do you weigh the difference between the two? And he says, well, lust isn't likely to become a religion, although America might be proving that differently these days, if you look at what's happening online. But whereas art can become a religion and is a god, and that's what had happened to that artist, that the artist had kind of lost the sense of the god behind the art and was treating it as if it was an end in itself.
And frankly, that's what happened to the mother, too. Who?
Yes. And didn't you love the way she perceived herself as someone who loved completely and too much, but George MacDonald said her problem was that she loved too little. There was a defect in love. I'm sure you folks out here have some amazing questions to ask tonight. They're all leaving for the door, for those of you listening to podcasts. But if you do have a question tonight, raise your hand, and I'm going to bring a microphone so we can get this on tape. And just give us your first name and then real quickly your question. Try to keep your questions succinct.
I'm Bill, and my question is, does any religious tradition give you a second chance once you're in hell, like it's portrayed in the play or in the story?
Yeah, he has the line, is there a way from hell to heaven?
In Judaism, we don't talk a lot about that there, but what we do talk about is the notion of repentance, that almost any sin, you know, is undoable, is intransformable into something good. The rabbis talk about the constant remaking of the self, we don't really go into much detail about what happens after we're gone. But I think the afterlife in Judaism is seen as a way. It was embraced by the rabbis, I think, as a way to continue believing in a just world. If death is the end of everything, then Martin Luther King and Saddam Hussein are in the same place. And that's 6 feet under. But with something afterwards, then we can write the scores. Can that change after somebody dies? I suppose the emphasis is, well, we got to really focus on making it good here. That's the challenge.
Did you want to add anything to
that? With Christianity, I've never heard anybody really talk about someone getting out of hell and being successful at it. I try not to spend a lot of time thinking about hell. There's just no need to go there. But I do believe that God can do whatever she chooses, you know?
All right. Another question. Yes, over here. First name and your question.
My name is Jan, and it seems to me that God is not sending people to heaven or hell. It's like it's our choice. It's not God's choice. It's our choice. Would you say speak about that?
That's what the play indicated, that it is about individual choice as to where they choose to live eternity.
God isn't saying go to hell. We're saying I choose hell.
And if God would choose to give someone another chance to, you know, to say maybe that wasn't such a good idea, that God could do that too.
I would add this, according to everything I, you know, the tiny little glimpses that I've gotten and the little pieces of understanding I've gleaned as a student of Judaism, is that, again, the question is, what kind of a person are you going to become? God doesn't determine that for us. Our Jewish tradition says that everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. In other words, God controls everything except what kind of person you're going to become. At the same time, God wants us to be good. God grieves when we fall short. God invites us at every moment to fulfill our great and awesome potential as human beings. And that is that provides the power and the passion and the drive of a sacred life.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that Lewis was trying to do in this book was by allowing these people to come to grips with who they were and whether they would choose to give up that aspect of themselves that was keeping them from becoming who they should be, was he wanted to show that God is loving and caring and wants to give every opportunity and wants to give you an opportunity to see who you are and who you might be. And so he did that through these recurring characters. Another question tonight. Yeah, way back here in the back.
Was all the gray a reference to Seattle?
That's why you had a Starbucks coffee symbol right up over in the corner.
The real question is, I also wonder if Lewis is more interested in the question of reality versus less than reality, as opposed to heaven and hell. And there's a certain irony that he uses an allegory to explain reality.
Yeah. Scott?
Yeah, I would agree with that, David, that the takeaway is not to remember this book when you're in purgatory. That's not the point. But rather, how does it change you right now and what is real? The idea that the people getting to heaven and know, but this is now reality. Everything here is hard, solid, and glorious and beautiful and fulfilling. And what you had before, what you thought was reality and to be longed for, is a shadow. And if I could comment on the costume designer and the colors, I'm going to comment for you, Sarah, and I'll hopefully do you justice, is that Sarah had a rather specific vision that the fact that within the mind of God, you'd have this explosion of color and intensity and purity and vibrancy. And for me, it was almost like seeing tropical fish. Yeah. It's like there's no reason for them to be that color. But they're intense and they're gorgeous. And so what if that was part of the population of heaven, was just this intensity and explosion of brilliance and creativity and color and fulfillment?
Yeah.
So I hope I did you right, Sarah. There, thank you.
In the book, Lewis talks about deep heaven, and he describes liquid love and brightness. And it's very much this point of becoming that Lewis believed very much on your question of reality, that the connection with God and the pursuit of God is what, in fact, actualizes you as a human. And so he wrote a lot about that, because he believed that that's the way we become who we are supposed to be. And there was a line at the end of this play, whoever uttered the line can tell us what the exact line is. It's the gift whereby you most resemble who, yeah, it's
freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really brilliant line. Any other quick questions? We're going to wrap this up in a minute because we know you've been through a wonderful experience tonight and you got a lot to think about. Your first name and your question?
Inez. I was wanting to know the meaning of the people that were having such a hard time walking around. I don't understand. They looked like they were kind of stuck in molasses or something. But it was,
sure.
They talked about hard grass. And
right. It was described as that the grass was like diamonds. And it's also part of that metaphor, the fact that the people who came on the bus thought they were solid, but they weren't. And the people of heaven were now real and solid and could run on the grass, play in the grass, sit on the grass. And it was never a place where the shadow people could be at home. It was always going to be difficult. But the metaphor was that as they would choose to go towards the mountains, they would become more solid and they would be able to walk.
See, can I respond to that for a moment? Because yeah, that struck me in the play. And I guess theologically, I would ask, why isn't God then trying to help us become more real? I mean, you know,
Lewis would argue that God is. But he also says, if I find in myself a desire which cannot be fulfilled in this earth, it must mean that I've been made for another place. So he believed that we become as fully human as we can in this life, but the full actualization happens in the next life. It's his way of dealing. Now, remember, he wrote this right after World War II. He was in World War I. He had seen death and dying and suffering, and he just did not believe that the full expression of who we were created to be as individuals or in community, would be actualized in this place.
Or could be actualized, it sounds
like. Could be actualized in this place. But that is our aim. And actually, you're putting your finger on one of the weaknesses of a lot of Christianity, which tends to think too much about heaven and not enough about becoming who God made us to be now. So that's a useful corrective. Yeah. Thank you, Rabbi. Everyone who is a Christian has been influenced by a rabbi, by the way.
So my name is Fred, and my question is this sort of autobiographical material for C.S. Lewis in the development of his own faith journey, and does it where would it sort of fit in that journey that he had?
Well, Lewis became his journey to belief. He started out as a believer as a child. His mother died when he was 8 years old. He began a journey of disbelief, which continued until after he had completed school, and he discovered that the people he was most attracted to in school were actually people who were Christian, which just irritated him because he was an atheist. His turning point was a gradual one as he began a journey out of atheism towards into an agnosticism and then into a theism, and it was in a walk with J.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson, called Addison's Walk, that they had a conversation with him about myth, and they all loved myth. They loved the Norse myths, and Tolkien said, "But Lewis, don't you understand? Beneath all myths, there's one true myth." And for the first time, Lewis could conceive of the Christian construct as a myth that is the true myth. So his journey, his Christian faith was around 1930. This was written 15 years later. A companion piece that's an interesting piece is Screwtape Letters, which is his book where he actually deals with a devil mentoring another devil. And this was kind of going the other direction into heaven. I'd like to ask any of the cast members if you have anything you'd like to add, just in terms of as you've been dealing with this material, any kind of insights that you've had, any of these questions of kind of what's going on in this heaven-hell thing. Any of you have anything you want to say? Let's go over here to this fine young man. Tell us your name, what you played in the production, and what your comment is, if you have any brain cells left after that grueling production.
My name's David. I played C.S. Lewis. I think the thing that I was dealing with is just at the very end of the play, what we talked about a lot was the choice. Everything's about the choice that the characters get when they get into heaven. Do they really have a choice is Lewis's question. He's desperate to find out whether these people have a choice because otherwise it's not really fair, it seems. So they have to have a choice. So we get all the way through the play. We establish that they have a choice. Great, freedom is the way that you most resemble your maker. And then suddenly all's changed and we've got predestination. And everything's been sorted out before we've even started. It's all superlapsarian and all that. But the interesting thing is that Lewis just puts that there. It's not like there's a discussion of the superlapsarianism or predestination or anything like that in there. So it's really not a full allegory or analogy about how Lewis thinks about salvation. It's more of an exhortation to living truly as a Christian, I think. So it's not supposed to spur us into thinking these long, not that this isn't lovely, but it's not supposed to spur us into these long theological discussions. It's supposed to spur us into action.
Well, I'm wearing black tonight, so I'm not in my color costume, so I'm on the dark side. Anybody over here have a comment, any of the other cast members? Other than you did a wonderful job.
I'm Pam, and I played a group of characters. But one of the things I think that struck all of us as we were working with the material was we kept seeing all of the ghosts in our own lives. And that's a wonderful thing when we recognize ourselves in those that we see in the midst of struggle and choosing, see our faults, see what we would like to aspire to move towards. That's good stuff. And I think if that's what happens for us, whether we're reading or seeing, we've been impacted in a pretty positive way. And I think all of us as actors were impacted in that way, that what we do today, what we choose today, the smallest choices that we make today, do make a difference in our life and in the lives of those around us.
If I added,
you were on stilts, right?
I was on stilts.
About this panel, stilts? I've never seen you do this before.
Dick, if I added to the choice comment of Pam's, and I think, Rabbi, that even in your tradition, talk about we choose as a community. We're still a community of individuals, right. But I choose to bond with you to accomplish these greater things. So it still comes back to whether I will lock arms with my brother and sister to accomplish things for the betterment of my neighbors right now.
It was a wonderful production. It was one that I would love to see again because I have the sneaking suspicion that I would see many things the next time I see it that I didn't catch this time. It was wonderfully done.
We're almost sold out, but I can get you in. So call me. Call me.
I'll call you.
And I would share that sentiment and just conclude by saying that from where I sit and the world that I see around me is plenty real enough that I want to try to deal with this world and together with all of us try to make the best of it that we possibly can.
Well, and that's a good note on which to end and to concur with what C.S. Lewis over here said, which is that Lewis ends this story by saying, I beg readers to remember that this is a fantasy. It has, of course, or I intended it to have, a moral. But the transmortal conditions are solely an imaginative supposal. They are not even a guess or a speculation at what may actually await us. The last thing I wish is to arouse factual curiosity about the details of the afterworld. Just as we've heard tonight, C.S. Lewis's point in this is not to get us thinking more about the afterlife, it's to get us thinking more about how we are living in this life. This is Dick Soblitz. Have a big round of applause for our...